Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Many thanks to the organizer for inviting me to give a talk to this workshop. I really like to be there. I always like to visit Perimeter, but unfortunately, I didn't get my visa in time. And yeah, and the website of the visa, it says that from UK, if you apply, it takes 270 days to get the visa, which I thought it's a joke, so I applied anyway. But apparently it's not a joke. And according to Canada, the only way that I could be there is that my future self would have told me that I would get invited to this conference at some point. Anyway, so yeah, so very sad I couldn't be there with you. But I'm happy I can talk to you about some of the stuff that I like to talk about. About the talk itself, I have to say, and maybe apologize, that my talk is not going to be very technical. But because the theme of this workshop resonated a lot with the spirit of the research that I do and I really enjoy and like, I couldn't only pick one work and talk about it. So I'm going to give an overview of some of my works and some of other people's work that I really like and admire. So hopefully I'll be able to paint a picture and get out some ideas that hopefully you also find interesting. So the core of my talk is, as per the title, is about quantum unclonability, which might sound like a very outdated topic because like no cloning is the first thing that anybody, like one of the first things that anybody learns when they learn quantum information. But at the end of this talk, I'd be hopefully able to convey is that unclonability is a very fundamental concept that's just beyond no cloning theorem. And the picture that I'd like to paint is something like that. So I will try to talk about a lot of things and hopefully be able to tell you how these things connect to each other and how they can help us to understand better the foundations of quantum and as well as how we can use them to get useful applications. So I start with more like well-known things, which is the connection between quantum unclonability and quantum cryptography. And one thing we kind of like all know is that a lot of quantum cryptographic protocols, they are directly or indirectly related to the fact that you cannot clone quantum states. So even if you don't use no cloning as part of your proofs when you're writing a security proof in a lot of this protocol like QKD, universal blind, quantum computing, quantum money, coin flipping, even if you don't do that, inherently, if you imagine a world where quantum mechanics like would allow you to clone quantum states, none of these security proofs would go through. And it's not just the famous ones that we know, there are like other fancier quantum functionality that people have developed over the years. Things like quantum copy protection software, unclonable encryption, quantum zero knowledge proofs. So some of these works I've done by Anne, who is, I believe, there. I really like and enjoy some of her works about these topics. But the thing is that, so we already know and we understood over the years that these two things, so the fact that we can have interesting results in quantum cryptography is related to the fact that we cannot clone quantum states. On the other hand, we also know that no cloning theorem is related to other no-go results in quantum. So in a way, the way I like to think about it is that no cloning is not just about the fact that you cannot clone, but is more of a way of quantum mechanics telling us what are the things that we cannot do. And some of these are very well known, things like no signaling, no deleting theorem, no broadcasting theorem. And some of them are less well known, maybe things like no superposition theorem. But the thing is that, so it's true that if you cannot clone quantum state, and due to very fundamental reason that you cannot clone quantum state, there's a lot of like other things that you cannot do. And natural question is that what else is there? Like what are these other limitations of things that we cannot do? And the one that I particularly like to talk about is the connection between unclonability and learning. So to convey my message, I start with a simple example. So the statement of no cloning theorem is that if you have an unknown quantum state, there is no unitary transformation that gives you two perfect, exactly the same copies of this quantum state. On the other hand, we know that if I have a classical description of my quantum state, I can prepare as many copies as I want, because I know what a state I'm preparing, and this has nothing to do with the fact that you cannot clone. But there is other things that you can do in between, which in a way, I like to see them as a spectrum between these two cases. And this is called approximate cloning. So you can start with a completely unknown state and get two clones that are not perfect, but they're like somehow clones of my state. And then you, as much as you have prior information about the set of states you can clone, we know from the literature about approximate cloning that you can get better and better clones, so the quality of your clone somehow increases. And again, we know that there is an interesting relation between state estimation and approximate cloning. And a state estimation is basically what we talk about as tomography, which is in a way the problem that you have number of copies of your quantum system and you want to know, learn the quantum state. So if you were in Amira's talk, which she made this like example very, very nicely, that tomography is actually a notion of learning. And by these copies, these are your data, and the object that you're trying to learn is a quantum state. So this is just an idea of why cloning and learning are kind of related. But where we see this connection much closer and nicer is where we expand from unclonability of quantum states to unclonability of quantum process. So first of all, what does it mean that I have an unclonable quantum process? And not surprisingly, I was not the first person who asked this question. So Chiribella in 2008, they asked and answered this question that, okay, you have an extended version of no cloning theorem, which is for processes. So if you have two black boxes, then you cannot perfectly clone them by single use. And there are two keywords in this unclonability notion, which I want to expand on and then get to the point that I want to get about this relation. So the first one is black box, which just means that, okay, if I don't know anything from them, these are being given to me as a black box. But actually, you can somehow expand or formalize this notion of black box in a way that you're sure that you've been given a process, which the only way that you can get any sort of data from that process is through querying it and getting the response. And one way of doing it is that you can say, okay, if I have a completely random state and I define an indistinguishability game in which I'm sending this state to either my black box unit tree or a completely random unit tree, I wouldn't know which one I've been given to. And if I can do that, like if I'm single use, I cannot make this distinction, then I'm sure that this is a black box practically. So this notion of black box I call a non-unitary, and for technical reasons, which I'm not gonna go into now, this is going to be a very useful notion of a black box. And the second point here is the single use. It's very natural to think what would happen if I want to define unclonability for processes, but I'm going to do more than single use. So what will happen if I use them multiple times? So what does that mean? So if I'm using a black box multiple times, so in multiple use of a black box, I have a bunch of quantum states that I send into this black box and I get the outcomes. And basically, if what I mean by not being able to clone is that if now I get a, let me see, where's my pointer? Yeah. If I get a quantum state from some sort of like distribution, then not being able to clone, meaning that I'm not able to produce the outcome of this unitary over this state. And Now, for a second, if you forget about anything that I told you about cloning and you think about Amira's talk about learning theory and about learning, you will see that what I'm just describing to you is a description of a learning problem. Because I have a black box, some sort of data from the black box, and I have a target which is related to, it's either a function of my input or it's the input directly, and I want to learn something. So when you try to very naturally generalize the notion of unclonability of quantum processes, you will face a learning problem. And the message here is actually now that, so the extended notion of unclonability can be defined through the notion of learnability. And how we do it? So here I like to mention a quote by Feynman that, well, what I cannot create, I do not understand. So my version of Feynman's quote, which I think what quantum mechanics is trying to tell us, is that what I cannot learn, I do not clone. So inherently in any kind of cloning process, even approximate or anything that we call cloning, there is some notion of learning that's been going on. And so, yeah, I talk about learning and I did not say what I mean by learning, but fortunately, Amira talked before me and she perfectly described this monument of work that people have done that's called learning theory. And this is a very nice method of formalizing what do we mean by learning something. So I'm just like gonna go briefly over this. So you have an algorithm and you have data, and learning means that the algorithm kind of like interacts with the data and outputs an object. And in learning theory, we usually like formalize this data and its interaction with the algorithm by an oracle. And for different levels of learning, you can define different oracles. So Amira talked about pack learning. You can define quantum versions of those, which is quantum pack learning. And there is a notion that she not mention, and I will mention, and this is the notion of statistical query learning, which existed in classical. And you can generalize this into quantum as well. But the idea is that, okay, so the oracle, it describes your access model and how your data is gonna look like. And then another thing that's important is that you need a distance measure. So because the object that the algorithm outputs, you want it to be close to something that you expect to be the answer to your question. So you have a distance measure or some empirical measure, something like cost function, which people in QML use a lot, that tells you how close to the actual target of your learning you are. So this is all that about the learning theory, but what's that? Take home message. The take home message here is that, well, different flavors of unclonability can be defined based on different formal notions of learning that you can get from learning theory. And this is very interesting because now we have a lot of like unclonability, if you want, and we can like talk about them and we can see what are their consequences. So I'm gonna add one other block of this puzzle. And I'll tell you, and hopefully this thing that I'm trying to say makes even more sense, because this is going to be a concrete example of this thing. Okay, so we think that the only notion of unclonability that exists in nature is from quantum mechanics, but this is actually not true. So people, I think initially from electrical engineering have faced another version of unclonability, which I'm going to tell you about. And this notion is called physical or physically unclonable functions. The idea is that, let's say you have a factory that produces crystals. So in the product line, you have crystals that are very similar. So they're kind of like copies of each other. But if you actually really closely look into them, you'll see that there's a lot of microscopic structure of the crystal that's not at all the same. So it's very unique actually. But they, from the outside, they look all the same. But the thing is that this formation of the crystal is so uncontrollable that even the manufacturer cannot ensure that every two crystals on the product line have the same sort of underlying microscopic structure. And if you can somehow interact with this piece of physical device and extract that unique behavior, then this is something very cool, because in a sense, this is physically unclonable. So you could not be able to exactly clone it, even from the start. But you can extract this behavior to some extent. And why this is cool? Because you can use this as a physical key. And well, you can think that, okay, it's going to be very natural and interesting if we think about this concept existing in the quantum world. And it is true. So I have worked a lot on this topic, and like there's actually like a framework in which you can define quantum physical and quantum functions and talk about them. But very roughly speaking, quantum paths or quantum physical and quantum functions, they are like quantum processes that are hard to clone. And the challenge and responses are basically the quantum states that you send through this process and you get it up. But the interesting thing is that like physical things like, for instance, optical devices like a crystal, you can think about them and you can study them and you can work with them as quantum paths as well. So this model actually also works in practice. Okay, so what about quantum paths? The interesting thing here is that what if I try to clone a physically uncloned function? So how that can be? So the idea is that, okay, so I told you that you interact with the device and you have some sort of like input and output, some sort of database, right? And so if you create this database, and if I give you this database of input and output, if you give it to a machine learning algorithm, and then the machine learning algorithm can create a model of the underlying function that existed for the thing that relates this input and output, let's say this f of x, then if your machine learning algorithm is good, so that your PAF model is good, you can actually produce as many f as you want. So even though physically by hardware assumption this is not clonable, in practice this is clonable. And this is what we call a breaking a PAF, or more cryptography speaking, forging a PAF. And this actually happens for classical PAF. So most of the things that people have defined in the literature as classical PAF, you can easily break them, because if you do this trick during the learning, they're not resistant to machine learning algorithms. So almost all the classical PAF that we know, they break against these kind of attacks. And so they become clonable. So what's the case? So how we can formalize this hardware assumption of unclonability? And so since Robert has his favorite triangle, I thought that I create mine as well. So my triangle doesn't have contextuality yet, but it has unforgeability, which is a cryptographic concept, which tells you that from things that you have already seen before, you're not able to create a new instance that's valid. There's learnability, which I talked about, and unclonability, both in the quantum information sense and hardware assumption. And the way we can now think about this and talk about this is that, okay, so now if I have an unknown unit tree, I can have a list of input and output of this unit tree, which would be essentially the same as the database I'll talk about. And then if you give this to a adversary or a learner, you can call it both, what you don't want to happen is that when you're giving a new input to this adversary, they're able to approximately produce something equal to U rho U dagger, which is the output of the unit tree. So you don't want this to happen. So if this happened, which is learning the process in a way, and it's forgery in the cryptographic language, then you don't have practical unclonability. So practical unclonability, or the actual important notion of unclonability, is that it is unforgeable and it is not learnable in this learning model. So that's how you can formalize. And based on this like notion, then we can actually now have new no-goes and new possibilities and impossibilities about these concepts of physically unclonable objects. So the things that we have shown, for instance, is that some like a stronger notion of, like, say, learnability or unforgeability, unlearnability or unforgeability, you cannot have. So if you have a quantum process, you interact with it in a certain way, and you specify your winning condition in a certain way, there are like some levels of this unforgeability property that you cannot have. So it's impossible to have them, because there will always be attacks. So these objects are actually learnable. I will not go through the details of what exactly these definitions of existential and universal mean, but it's just to tell you that there are certain levels of this thing that abstractly we can say that you know, it's forbidden. You cannot have anything useful there. And in general, one thing that is interesting is that it's impossible to have any sort of useful notion of physical unclonability or unforgeability if you're picking your target state somehow, even like at random and like hiddenly, but the target state lies in a polynomially sized subspace that the adversary somehow they can extract or they know beforehand. So for instance, if you have somehow already public database, even if you send your queries and challenges to quantum state, you might think that maybe you have security there, but you actually don't, because the database is extractable by the adversary and it's always polynomial size. So the reason is that there is a quantum algorithm, it's called universal quantum emulator. And what it does is exactly mimics the output of an unknown unit tree from the data, from the input and output of the unit tree. And if you use this algorithm, if you change this algorithm a little bit, which we did, and use it in a specific way, you can show that, yeah, there are like, you can get this, like, all these no-go results that I'm talking about. Yeah, and in a way, if I want to draw a picture about this, like, polynomial size no-go theorem, is that, so you have a big Hilbert space over, let's say, n samples, like n qubit, which is where your unit tree is. If the adversary can somehow see or extract which subspace, which polynomial size subspace you're picking your instances from, then you're doomed, because even though this still seems like a very hard problem, it actually, the adversary can actually win the game or learn. So you need some sort of effective dimensionality of these devices to be exponentially high. And by that, I mean that even if you pick like limited number of samples and work with them, these subspaces is like well hidden in exponential Hilbert space. And this is very crucial to have unforgeability or unlearnability. And well, basically now the good side of it and the possibility result is that if you have an unknown unit tree, which is exactly the notion I defined before, then this is enough to satisfy universal unforgeability, which is essentially, if I'm giving you any new random state, you would not be able to, on average, learn or mimic the outcome of the unit tree. And this is very useful because this notion of unforgeability is enough to do a lot of useful cryptography. And this is actually a provable property of physical unclonability, whereas we did not have that before in the classical notion of physical unclonability. And so basically the way you do the proof is that you show this unit trees, which are in single shot indistinguishable to harm measure, then in multiple shot that you can prove that they're still unlearnable under this assumption. And when I did this proof, unfortunately, I did not know any learning theory. So I did the proof in a different way. But these days I know that, yeah, you have a lot of like cool tools from learning theory that you can use to prove this kind of a statement. Okay, but now I wanna talk about another like interesting like similarity that we see in the field. And this is actually something that's very hot these days. And where else do we see something like just the kind of like proofs and the result that I described to you? And now maybe not very surprisingly because of the building I did so far through the talk, it's in QML, in variational algorithm. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that like this paper on the right, which is a very cool paper in QML. Zoe was here actually around 2 weeks ago at the conference we had in Edinburgh, and she gave a talk about this. And okay, so what's the idea here? The idea is that there is a trade-off in quantum machine learning between two very important notions in learning. One is expressivity, and the other one is trainability, which is related to this notion that maybe you heard a lot about, which is called Baran plateau. And I'm gonna briefly explain what this is. So expressivity, very hand-wavy, roughly speaking, is that you basically you have like your whole unit tree group, and you have a parameterized circuit, And based on your, like the space of your parameters, there is a subspace of the whole unitary group that you can access to that parameterized circuit. And so basically it's the relation between the size of the accessible space and the whole unitary group. So if you can span a lot in the unitary group, means that your quantum machine learning algorithm can actually exploit the power of this exponential subspace exponential space that we kind of like think that's very useful. And so we like in KML to have high expressivity. But there's another problem so this space of your your parameterized landscape, basically, it can get very flat. So when you want to go from one parameter to another and optimize and learn something, if you have a very flat landscape, you're actually stuck. So you have no gradients and you don't know where to go. And the way this is usually formalized is by this is by saying that your variance of the variance of your cost function on your on the space of your parameters is exponentially small or is exponentially vanishing. And this is what people call band plateau. So what happens in QML or in variational algorithms is that there's a trade-off between these two. Usually when you have high expressivity, it happens to be that you have also band plateau, so you get a stuck, you have low trainability. And people have thought a lot about this and how to escape this and how to make quantum machine learning possible. And what this paper says that I found very interesting is that the cases which we actually could escape this parent plateau, you could also show that you're kind of like in a polynomially sized subspace, which your space that you actually explore, even though it might look like that you're exploring everywhere, you're not. You're actually confined in a polynomial sized subspace. And why this is bad? Because this polynomial sized subspace is classically achievable. So in a lot of these cases, you don't need to do quantum machine learning at all because you could do classical machine learning because now this is all simulable. So there's a very interesting concept here that why we care about this. This is because we want to understand where is it that quantum machine learning can work. And at the same time, we can have quantum advantage. So it's not something that we could have done classically. So the two questions that I like maybe you as well to think about is that, so first of all, can we make this formal connection between this effective dimensionality and polynomial subspace about the unclonable functions that I explained to you in the previous slide, and this notion of expressivity and its relation to trainability? The answer to this question, I think, is yes. So I just need to write it down. So I think all the material is there. So it's not very hard to see that this kind of like exists. The second question is that, well, if we do that, does that help us to understand better the quantum advantage of quantum machine learning? The answer to this question is I don't know, but it might be a new way of thinking about things and looking at things. So I'd like to share it with you. And well, you can keep doing this thing. So you can define basically different notions of quantum physical unclonable function. So you can maybe think about this model that, okay, so I have a black box, but I have a noisy version of it. And now instead of looking at the input and output quantum state, the output is basically the outcome of the measurement. So I only need to look at the statistics. And this model is kind of cool because you can think that I have a very simple unitary, a complicated noise model on top of it, which is what makes this physically unclonable. And well, this is actually good because I can go and build it in the lab because we have a lot of noisy hardware. We have no problem there. So it's a very constructible and useful notion of physical unclonable functions. The problem is that if you build something like that, it's been shown heuristically that you can, again, break them using not even very sophisticated machine learning algorithm. And well, what we thought about is that, okay, but the fact that this underlying circuit, so in this example, in this paper, what they did is the only rotation, single qubits in every line. So there's no entangling gates in this like example. But you can think that, okay, but like the underlying circuit is pretty simple. So what if we keep this model because it's nice, but we make the circuit a bit more complicated? Like, can we have something interesting there? And well, here learning theory helped us a lot, because we realized that this definition of a puff or a quantum process, you can not even think of a puff, but if you have this quantum process and you want to study it, you can study it in the quantum statistical query model. So we defined a framework for quantum statistical query of quantum processes, which is this like learning this thing. And if you study processes in this model, then you can see that, well, there are algorithms that's been designed to learn quantum processes or quantum channels, and we can reuse them again, change them, fit them into this new framework, and based on a new algorithm that now we have from quantum process statistical query model, we could show that, well, basically a large family of these type of puffs are learnable, and even if you make the underlying circuit as complicated as a hard random circuit, it doesn't help. It's due to this like access model that you can use some algorithm to learn them very, very efficiently, except some very restricted cases, which we think they're not efficient. But anyway, so yeah, so that's that. And if you think this is the end of the story, it's not. So looking at this like black hole of the relation between cryptographic properties and basically learning theory made us like see some very interesting results, which we are like sometimes surprised by them. And yeah, this is what I asked Dolly to give me when I asked him to give me what would it like to fish from a black hole, which is, I think, the situation my PhD student is in at the moment. So that's that. All right, so I talked about that. I'm gonna talk about the relation between unclonability and another very fundamental thing that we like and we use a lot, which is randomness and pseudorandomness. I'm gonna be very brief here because there's a lot to say, but I don't wanna go into a lot of details. But okay, so briefly speaking, true quantum randomness is when we sample from Hauer measure. If you wanna approximate that, there are usually two ways. If you think about a statistical approximation, which is like second moments, third moments of things being similar to Hauer measure, this is t-design. And you can think about it in a computational way, which gives rise to this notion of pseudorandom states and pseudorandom unitaries. So pseudorandom quantum states, it's been defined by Ji Liu and Song, 2018. And it's a set of keyed states or unitaries that they can be generated efficiently, but they're computationally indistinguishable to Hauer random states or Hauer random unitaries. And by computationally, it means that if a polynomially bounded quantum distinguisher interacts with these two, they would not be able to distinguish. So if you have n copies of, let's say, a pseudorandom quantum state, or if I give you m copies of a Hauer random state, again, you have a distinguishability game. And a distinguisher after interacting with these two should say, well, I don't know which situation I'm in, which world I'm in. And well, there's an interesting relation between unclonability and this notion, which is that you can define a computational version of no cloning theorem from pseudorandom states. And there's been like ever since this has been introduced over the past 6 years, there's been a huge body of research that are very, very interesting about just this topic, that it seems very simple, but it gives rise to a lot of cool results in cryptography, in complexity theory, and even in physics. I did not have space enough to mention all this paper, but I briefly mentioned some of them at the very end. And look, the thing that I like to ask and answer here is that, well, can we achieve pseudorandomness, quantum pseudorandomness, not under usual computational assumption, but from a different set of assumptions? So what if, for instance, we try to do it through hardware assumption? And well, the answer is yes. So if you have a family of quantum physical unclonable function, you can show that you can have a family of pseudorandom generators or pseudorandom operations, and Well, actually, yeah. So this connects the hardware assumption and unclonability to this computational assumption and notion of pseudo-randomness. And you can even like extend this result to some of the properties, which I did not talk about, but there are like beautiful theorems from random matrix theory, which you can show to prove that, yeah, if you have like unitaries that you spread them really well, they're actually pseudo-random unitaries or things like that. Anyway, I promise not to be technical, so I will not talk about that. So the last piece of the puzzle that I want to put, which is the favorite topic of this conference, I believe, is contextuality. So, okay, what's with contextuality and unclonability? So it starts from this question that is no cloning theorem really as non-classical as we think? Is it like a truly quantum property? And well, no, according to this paper, you can have no cloning theorem and no broadcasting in general, in GPTs, in general probability theories. But well, like more generally, if you don't only think about no cloning, and if you think about this a bit more expanded version of unclonability, people have shown that you have contextuality actually for state-dependent cloning. So it was these two papers, they're both very interesting, and it got me a bit confused that, okay, what's going on? So what is it? Do we really have, like, is it a really non-classical property? Is it not? So I went to my friend and colleague in Royal Holloway, Farid, who knows a lot about contextuality, and we talked. So I talked a lot about cloning. He taught me about Speckens contextuality, and this is all the phases that we went throughout this project, thinking about a lot of things and scratching our head. And at the end, we came to the conclusion that, well, maybe we need a new way of witnessing contextuality. And I'm not going to spoil more than that, because Farid is going to give a short talk in the Gong Show about this. It's called Contextuality via Dimension Witnesses. But this is the way that we found that if we do that, then we're able to generally solve this problem and talk about the relation between cloning and contextuality. So yeah, if you're interested, go to Farid's talk. And well, basically, in terms of application, or in a sense why we're here, because we want to understand better quantum advantage, this is the treasure hunt map that I draw based on the things that I talk about. So if here, this is the quantum treasure, which is the quantum advantage we like to get or we like to understand. And so what I think is that the extended notion of unclonability, I hopefully could convince you that it links a lot with learning. So it connects us to learning theory, and by using both of this, maybe we are able to understand better quantum machine learning and to understand better where is it in learning tasks that we have an actual quantum advantage. It connects to cryptography, and the cool thing about it is that it gives us new sets of assumptions to work with, things like hardware assumption and things like quantum pseudo-randomness, which I did not talk about this, but it's actually, people have shown that this is a fundamentally different notion of, different assumption that you can use in cryptography. And well, based on these, you can design new useful protocols, and protocols that have unique feature that is unique to quantum. So they don't have like classical counterparts, or there are like some features of them that is better than classical. So you can do identification protocols, authentication protocols. You can do distributed quantum computing. I did not do this yet, but this year I did. Based on pseudo-randomness, people have done a lot of cool works to show that you can do, just based on quantum pseudo-randomness, you can do commitment, digital signature, MAC, a lot of like interesting cryptographic functionalities. Another interesting thing is that quantum pseudo-randomness has a very interesting connection to physics, to be specific to wormhole growth and AdS/CFT. And again, from there, lately we have seen that there's a lot of cool ideas of algorithms that are based on weird physical assumption, or for instance, what if you have black hole radiation and stuff like that. So these two references, check them if you're interested specifically. But what I'm trying to say is that there we also have a new way of looking at quantum advantage or things like that. So in conclusion, an extended notion of unclonability, I think it's very cool. It's not at all outdated and it can teach us a lot about a lot of things. The study of unclonability and its relation to learning theory hopefully teach us new way of thinking about where and, oh, my time is over, where and when we have advantage in learning. And so unclonable primitives, they're actually very useful in cryptography. We can build a lot of applications based on them. And there's a very non-trivial and interesting relation between contextuality and unclonability. And what are the future directions? So I listed just like a bunch of questions that I really like. Most of them I already talked about. The thing that I maybe did not talk about is this one here, that I like to also understand that can I go through this like path and to see what is the what is the relation between contextuality and learning as well. And with that, I do a little bit of advertisement for a PhD position in Edinburgh that I will supervise jointly with Farid about understanding better this like aspects of foundations and things like unclonability and things in cryptography. And with that, I thank you so much.
Thank you, Mina. Questions from the audience here? Some people taking pictures of the last slides, I can see. I did the same thing. Any questions? I have a question, Mina. So when you presented some circuits that could be used as quantum puffs at the end of your quantum puff part, and you mentioned also that you were considering a quantum black box, like unitaries that you apply, a noisy one. Mm-hmm. Does noise play a role in the QPuffs? Have people looked at not unitary circuits, but you know, noisy circuits, open systems in that context?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in the So in the initial framework that we had for quantum puffs, we did not look at the noisy ones. So we only look at the unitaries or close to unitary puffs because of some technical. So there's like a specific property that it's very nice to work with actually. And if you beyond unitaries or close to unitary channels, then you lose that property. So you have to have a looser version of that property. So for that reason, we mostly work with unitaries. But actually, you can. So you can have you can loosen that condition a little bit and have a noisy version of a quantum puff. And this is still useful. But as far as I know, there's no security or unforgeability proof for that yet. But then there's this like basically classes of puffs that they're noisy process and you don't care about actually learning the quantum state as an output, but you care about learning the expectation values over some observable. And this is exactly this one that I was explaining here. And yeah, our result here is that you cannot have a useful unclonability because these are in many cases for almost all the useful observable that we know, they're learnable. So they're efficiently learnable. So it's useless. Like you can have a very complicated noise channel over a very complicated unit tree and still not have the good property that you want to have.
Okay, thanks. We have questions here, local audience. Maybe online, do we have any questions from people online? You can speak up if you want. We don't seem to. So let's thank Mina again. Thank you, Mina, for joining.